Hey, are we live yet? Are we live yet? Testing. 1, 2, 3. Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's online podcast with your host, Jan Irvin. Here we investigate the religious, the mysterious, the entheogenic, the shamanic, and the Gnostic with the small g. Haven't heard it someplace else, you'll likely hear it here. So sit back and relax. Take a trip through time and a journey through your mind as we investigate the ancient mysteries.
Welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 24. I'm your host, Jan Irvin. Today's guest is Dr. Brian Akers, the author of The Sacred Mushrooms of Mexico. What were the mushroom traditions of ancient Mexico? Was there just one mushroom cult? Or were there diverse practices spread across many different cultures? What were some of Gordon Wasson's most important contributions to ethnomycology? And what is the importance of the mystic or transpersonal experience? From mycology to anthropology, to mystical experiences. This conversation is an intellectual feast. Dr. Brian Akers earned his PhD in mycology from Southern Illinois University, specializing in mushrooms, especially the Lepiota group, a parasol mushroom and its allies, and also possesses a master's in anthropology and a bachelor's in comparative religion from Western Michigan University. He is the author of The Sacred Mushrooms of Mexico, Assorted Texts, which was published in 2007 by University Press of America. And he's also the author of a series of journal publications on fungi and ethnomycology. He served a 10-year term as biology professor at several universities and colleges, including the University of Minnesota at Morris. And he was born and raised in Detroit and currently lives in Tampa Bay, Florida. Upcoming shows, we have next week Professor Carl Ruck, the author of The Hidden World, and, oh, amongst many other books, contributed to the famous Persephone's Quest, as well as The Road to Ulysses that just came out in a 30th anniversary edition, as well as Sacred Mushrooms of the Goddess, and Apples of Apollo, amongst many other books, including language books and things like that. Also upcoming week after next will be Dr. Dennis McKenna. I hope to get that recorded tomorrow. And also coming up is Professor Emeritus Marlene Dobkin de Rios. A Hallucinogenic Tea Laced in Controversy is her latest book, and that is on ayahuasca in the Amazon and the United States. Also coming up will be Dr. Marguerite Rigoglioso, who is the author of the new book coming out on April 27th called The Cult of Divine Birth in Ancient Greece. And this is going to be a good one. This is going to be on fertility cults, which I've been wanting to get into for some time. So I'm really happy to have her on. And also Judith Ann Brown regarding that. It looks like March has passed, so another deadline has been passed for the reprinting of The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. Again, we will keep you posted on that. I will probably just wait to mention it until I have good news. So next time you hear about this will be good news. And if anyone out there in the audience can do transcriptions, I'd still like to get all of these shows transcribed. So if you can help with that, please contact me. I have had a few people contact me and have offered to do a few of the shows, but there are still more that need to be done. So if you can help, send me an email to contact@gnosticmedia.com. And this show is run on donations, so if you would like to support this programming, please go to www.gnosticmedia.com and click on the donations button at the top left of the page. This show is not corporate media. It is independent media in the truest sense of the words. And by supporting it, you help continue this programming. And without your help, we wouldn't be here. So we really appreciate it. And we really appreciate everyone who has been donating in the last few weeks and took up on the book offers and things like that. I do still have copies of the brand new second color edition of Astrotheology and Shamanism, and I'm sending that out with a free copy of the Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD that is the companion to the book, and that by itself is a $20 value, so you're getting $20 off the deal total. And you can also get the color edition as well as the black and white edition off of Amazon. The second edition in black and white is $20 or $21 plus shipping and handling if you'd like to get that off of the Gnostic Media website. A lot of new updates and things like that in there for those of you who are interested. I also still have copies of my newest book, The Holy Mushroom, which will go along great with John Rush's book, Failed God, as well as John Allegro's The Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. And we really appreciate your support. And if you'd like to go to the website and check out the forums or check out whatever else is on the website, you can go to Gnostic Media. That's www.gnosticmedia.com. And you can also check out the Pharmacratic Inquisition DVD for free on the website. Just click on the link up at the top center of the page, and the entire DVD is up for free viewing. It's also available in Portuguese, Dutch, and the Spanish translation of that has just been completed, so hopefully that will be available for viewing in the next week or two. I've had a little bit of trouble with audio. I had to get a new audio card for the computer, so hopefully the problems have been resolved, but I'm keeping my fingers crossed. And without further ado, here is my interview with Dr. Brian Akers. All right, Brian, welcome to Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 24. How are you today?
I'm fine, Jan. How are you doing?
Good. It's good to talk to you today.
Likewise.
I hope we can pull out a decent show here. You and I talk about many wide-ranging topics and in some of our conversations, so hopefully we'll be able to keep it a little bit more focused than our normal conversations, but I'm willing to give it a try.
Well, I'll be with you on that, and it's a treat to be here. Thanks for having me on your show.
And you're welcome. Thanks for coming on. I really appreciate it. You're a biologist specializing in fungi with a PhD in mycology, and you've also got degrees in religion and anthropology, and this is a pretty unusual background, but it's certainly well suited for studying ethnomycology. Can you tell us about your research and how you got into this field, how you got interested in it?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, and it's a very focal question because actually, as I'll tell you, the psychedelic drug thing has everything to do with it. And you're right, you know, my background is in comparative religion, which, you know, is not really theological study or preparing to become a religious person. It's just sort of sampling and learning all about all the various religious traditions and teachings of peoples around the world and, you know, making comparisons and contrasts in order to be able to reach some kind of knowledge and understanding about them, quite apart from any sort of personal aspect of, you know, well, which religion is the best religion or something like that. And that was my undergraduate major when I attended college. But when I first attended college in the mid-1970s, I really didn't know what I wanted to study or do with my life. And, of course, I'm still trying to sort that out to some extent, like the rest of us, I suppose. But it was as an undergraduate living in the dorm that I was exposed through social and interpersonal connections and friends and acquaintances to the effects of cannabis intoxication, which I found rather interesting because, you know, for all the fun and relaxing and euphoric aspects of it, there also seemed to be a very curious sort of stimulation of experience at a level that spans the thinking mind and the feeling mind and something that I would call a kind of a psycho-spiritual awareness. There was some kind of fine, detailed texture of thought that was really rich, and I found it very interesting. And in commenting on this to friends, they said, well, you know, you might find the effects of psychedelic drugs like LSD really interesting if that's how you see it. And so it was really, that was the stimulus that prompted me in this undergraduate directionless stage of my life to, you know, have a few psychedelic experiences with mushrooms and LSD, and this would have been about 1975. And the thing that amazed me in connection with my, you know, first psychedelic experiences was something that none of my friends had said anything about or said anything to prepare me for in the least. Namely, I experienced this phenomenon, which subject of studies by Roland Griffiths, who you had on your show, what we might call mystical experience, or as it was called about a century ago in a book by Dr. R.M. Buck, a classic of the field, cosmic consciousness. And this mystical experience aspect is really, you know, based on what I experienced, it seems to lie at the very core, at the very center of this entire fascinating phenomenon of the what we might call the mind-expanding effects or consciousness-expanding effects of psychedelic drugs. And there's lots of interesting stuff in that spectrum of effects, from trivial things like hilarity to more interesting things like a light that it seems to shed upon creative expression and creative visionary processes, as we've known from artists and musicians and poets and men of letters. And but really, at the core of it, at the center of the whole thing is this phenomenon of mystical experience. And when I experienced that, I was quite amazed and startled. And one thing that it did for me was it gave me a sense of what I probably might like to do in terms of a direction of my studies, because one aspect of this mystical consciousness is that it is undeniably in its nature something of a spiritual stirring or awakening or transcendence. And I realized in the wake of that that I needed to probably take stock, take inventory of the entire human legacy of religion and spirituality across culture. And so that was what prompted my decision to take up an undergraduate major in comparative religion, because I just intuitively felt in the wake of this kind of mystical psychedelic experience that the key to understanding what this was about had to lie in knowledge of all these traditions. You know, what do they have in common? What are their similarities? And also, what are their differences? And if we add it all up and analyze it, what does it really indicate? And what conclusions can we draw? And what kind of understanding can we reach? And, you know, I was just really, you know, one is never really quite the same. You know yourself very well that to experience the effects of these drugs is something that really goes to the very depths of your experience, and kind of it's an awe-inspiring experience, and it's very impressive, and it's not the kind of thing that you can just move on from afterwards and put out of your mind for the rest of your life. But am I answering your question okay?
Yeah. I might have you tie this into your first book, Sacred Mushrooms in Mexico, and the current one that you're beginning work on, or that you've been, you know, I've read, you sent me the first chapter of it. I might have you tie all of this into that.
Well, as I say, it was this very impressive experience of the mind-expanding effects of psychedelic drugs, especially this phenomenon of mystical consciousness that prompted me to take up study of religion, comparative religion, across culture. And to get a stronger cross-cultural focus, I also undertook graduate studies in anthropology and, you know, got my Master of Arts in that discipline, and really specializing and focusing in traditions of cultures that use psychedelic substances, you know, plants and fungi and so on, that contain psychedelic compounds as part of their deeply rooted and highly integrated cultural practices, apparently of long-standing ancient origin. And, you know, I really wanted to know what was going on with that and understand that, because it stands in such marked contrast to the situation of our culture. I mean, it's really a very strange situation we walked into, because, you know, as of before the mid-20th century, there was very little knowledge or awareness of the fact of these substances and the nature of their effects until, really, I would say 1943, Albert Hoffman's discovery of the effects of LSD, which he had only recently synthesized. And before that, there was an awareness of something called peyote, a cactus used by Indians in some of their religious rituals. And the effects of peyote, you know, were not something that were widely studied or well known, except in certain obscure research circles. And when LSD's effects were discovered, the analogy to mescaline was very striking. And that was really the beginnings of detecting the tip of an iceberg, namely the existence of a whole class of compounds with effects that are prominently LSD-like, this consciousness-expanding thing. And to this day, we're, I think, still only beginning to scratch the surface of this interesting phenomenon. And if I may, I'd like to suggest that based on the sum total of my studies and research and experience in this field, it seems to be something that I've concluded relates essentially and fundamentally to a very broad framework, namely what we might call the human condition, taking in aspects such as, well, what is sometimes conventionally referred to as the meaning of life. And there's some kind of depth to the human condition, to the human experience, that are normally out of our conscious mind. We come into contact with this aspect of our existence at various points during life when circumstances forcefully bring them to our attention. And for the most part, we kind of have to get on with the business of day-to-day life and put that stuff out of our mind. But every single one of us, I think, has had experiences that put us in contact with the depths of human experience, the human condition, the mystery, basically, of our existence, our origin, our fate, the meaning of life, what's it all about, Alfie. And some of these experiences are widely remarked upon. For instance, Jan, I wonder if you've ever had this interesting experience of standing outside at night under really clear weather conditions, and the stars are twinkling overhead, and they capture our attention, and we look up, and there is a funny, tingly sense of something that we are wondering, question that starts to arise, and we can't even really put words to that question necessarily.
Oh, sure.
It's an experience of awe. It's an experience of wonder. And there are many occasions, many common experiences, and you'll probably recognize these. I mean, just looking at a particularly majestic mountainous landscape, perhaps, or an unusually beautiful sunrise or sunset, or a rainbow, especially a really striking, vivid one, or some people see it in the beauty of the flowers. Whatever's on their mind, whatever's bothering them, all of a sudden they're confronted with the sight of these really beautiful flowers, and for a moment they are arrested. And now, me personally, I'm a little bit blind, maybe, to the beauty of flowers. I look at a beautiful flower. Yeah, that's beautiful. Of course it's beautiful. It's all colorful and whatnot. Flowers tend to be beautiful. And yet it's funny because all of a sudden some big, gorgeous swallowtail butterfly will come flying along and land on that flower, drinking the nectar and unwittingly pollinating it, its wings furiously beating the whole time. And suddenly, I'm caught. I'm transfixed with sort of marvel at its beauty. And someone might kid me and say, hey, what's the matter? Haven't you ever seen a butterfly before? And I don't have any explanation for why one image of natural beauty captures one person's attention, something else does it for another, but all of us have these moments where we're sort of transfixed by the wonder of existence itself and the fact that we're alive, and there's a kind of a mystery there to ponder, and it's something that kids at summer camp will have their little fun conversations about the meaning of life. It is something that actually, you know, when I look around the entertainment arts landscape, fiction and poetry and cinema, it's really a major central theme that is driving the storyline and character developments. And one of the interesting things, you know, 100 years ago when Dr. Buck brought out this book, Cosmic Consciousness, he had had an experience of extremely profound mystical enlightenment that really transformed his experience, and he wrote this book, Cosmic Consciousness, in which he discusses the cases of many figures in history, famous people whose writings revealed to him that they had also had some kind of brush with this, that they were very much aware, very much alive to the mystery and the depths and the awe of this aspect of human existence, and that they had probably had moments of mystical consciousness. And he includes figures like Walt Whitman and Emerson and Thoreau and certainly William Blake. And it's no coincidence that William Blake is the figure that was drawn upon by Aldous Huxley in 1954 for his book, The Doors of Perception, his book about mystical consciousness, mystical experience, and as he had experienced it in some psychedelic drug experiences, I guess administered by Dr. Humphrey Osmond, who was investigating the effects of LSD, and that was back in the 1950s. And so really, what led me along this path to eventually study not only comparative religion, but cultural anthropology and also mycology was, you know, my own drive to get a hold of whatever knowledge and information I could from all of various angles and different subjects that might shed light upon the story of this psychedelic experience, and working on a mystery and gathering what clues I could is something that began with those psychedelic experiences that I had as a college undergraduate that introduced me to this startling fact of mystical consciousness, which none of my friends had said anything about. And to this day, we have books like Doors of Perception by Aldous Huxley and others that look closely at this phenomenon. Another one that comes to mind is The Joyous Cosmology by Alan Watts. There's an excellent book that came out in 1967 called The Private Sea, LSD and the Search for God by Braden. And there are some excellent explorations of this theme. And there seems to be, I didn't realize when I experienced this that others had experienced it in connection with psychedelic drugs before me. And I was concerned when I experienced this for my own sanity because I thought maybe there was something wrong with me. And it was only in discussing this with people that my attention was drawn to the fact of, oh, no, what you're talking about is not something unique to you. And there have been, you know, the book Doors of Perception was brought to my attention. And when I read that, it was very reassuring because I realized that, no, this isn't me. I'm not going crazy here. What I experienced there is something that has been observed and discussed and described and explored by other authors. It's just that my friends who had brought this to my attention, you know, as far as their comments about it, it tended to be one-word things or little phrases like, ooh, colors, or, oh, wow, trails. And only the most superficial demonstrations of psychedelic drug effects were commented upon because those are things.
Well, I would totally agree with that. In fact, in the early days, that was myself. And, you know, for the first, well, I don't know how many times, quite a few times I had tried psychedelics. But at one point, I had one of those experiences that wasn't like all of the others and left me scratching my head going, oh, wow, what the hell was that? And, you know, did I just lose my mind, or was I the only one that ever experienced that? But, you know, by then I had met, actually probably that same day that I had that experience, I had just met Timothy Leary and Dennis McKenna and a number of these other guys. So I was kind of already set on a path to land on it. But you know, that after I met those guys, the first time I decided to properly alter my set and setting, it dramatically altered the course of the experience. You know, but I just wanted to mention it kind of seems like, you know, with all of this talk and all of these experts coming in and looking at this, that science and religion and spirituality are essential to the subject of entheogens, as Roland Griffiths points out, and, you know, I had him on the show a few months ago. But, you know, this topic repeatedly comes up in these discussions, and, you know, we've got to look at why is that, and, you know, what is this reverence for, you know, how do we get this reverence for each other, or how is it relevant for each other, and how does it give us this relevance and understanding for each other and this deeper level of meaning of ourselves and, you know, this perspective on all of this? What, you know, how did you arrive into all of that, and talk a little bit about that if you could?
Oh, no problem. You know, you're really, you know, putting your finger right on the fascinating core of this whole thing with mentioning these themes that continue to arise, especially spanning science and spirituality. And I think it was Peter Webster, whom you interviewed, who brought up this phenomenon of meaning and significance, and he uses the word salience. And, you know, this goes back to, you know, I made this little reference to the meaning of life. And this is where I think we see the fascinating encounter or connection at this deep level between perspectives coming from science with all this knowledge of nature, and meanwhile, religion with its orientation towards some kind of ultimate sacred truth, transcendence, and the spiritual. And, you know, again, you know, just like Buck, who saw traces of cosmic consciousness in other authors that, you know, with the eyes that he had gained, the new insight he had acquired from his own mystical experience, they say it takes one to know one. And he began to recognize others around him who, by their words and statements, had this experience. Same thing with Huxley in his book, The Doors of Perception, which takes its title from a poem by William Blake in Auguries of Innocence. If the doors of perception were but cleansed, everything would appear to man as it is. infinite. And, well, you know, Buck's book came out.
I was just going to add that I remember right after I had my first big transpersonal experience or whatever, galactic consciousness type experience, I remember I was in a park. I had actually put on a hemp rally at the park, and I had just had this experience, and somebody in the park was playing guitar and singing a song along with the guitar music, and I was listening to the lyrics of what he was singing, and I had to, you know, walk up to him and ask him, you know, hey, are you singing about this other experience, you know, through psychedelic drugs? And he said, well, I've heard of that, but basically he said, you know, I've had a lot of my own personal experiences outside of drugs that so it was like, you know, I understand what you're saying by going around and analyzing what other people's words and their art and poetry and things were. And then, you know, eventually that led me to meeting quite a number of other people who had this type of experience and talked about it or wrote about it and, you know, et cetera. I wanted to ask you real quick in your new book that you're writing right now, Through the Doors of Perception, you write, the cognitive and affective content of peak experiences with hallucinogenic fungi and similar agents of consciousness expansion is, in its essence, all about the broader, deeper, and universally personal aspects of the human experience in general. It spans the entire continuum of what we innocently call, quote-unquote, reality, from the personal to the cosmic. Would you discuss that quote?
Yeah, I'd be happy to, and it ties in, I think, in an interesting way with the comment about the guy playing the guitar who had had some kind of experiences, but not necessarily involving drugs. One of the most interesting perspectives to me emerging from all of this has to do with the whole nature of this entire phenomenon of psychedelic drug effects and the access that it provides to these, to the depths of human experience, where we find this psycho-spiritual, transpersonal foundation and core. And I don't think this is necessarily that widely or well understood, but the effects of psychedelic drugs and the access they provide are ultimately to the core and the essence of something that is uniquely human, the human condition, the meaning of life. In other words, things that are not exclusive to the effects of psychedelic drugs, but which rather are unique and fundamental to something much more universal, namely the human condition. And it's the light that these effects shed upon that, revealing all kinds of questions that lie deep at the core, that accounts for the significance and the unique importance of psychedelic drugs. And there is nothing unique or specific to psychedelic drug experience that is not part and parcel of this broader human condition and what lies at its depths, especially in terms of the meaning of life. And you mentioned this guy with the guitar and songs. You know, lyrics of songs do an incredible job in many cases of sort of spelling this stuff out. And a rather humorous example that comes to mind, Jan, have you ever seen, I don't know if you're a Monty Python fan, but have you ever seen a film called Monty Python's The Meaning of Life?
Yes, I have seen that. It's been a long, long time, but yeah, I've seen it.
Well, you know, for comedic purposes, and, you know, I certainly like my Monty Python, you know, movie sort of opens with this song that puts a really solid frame around the whole big topic with lyrics like, what is life? What's it about? Is God really real? Or is there some doubt? Well, tonight, for a change, we're going to sort it all out, for this is the meaning of life. Is life just a game where we make up the rules, sitting around with really nothing to say, while scientists claim we're just spiraling coils of some replicating DNA? Notice in those lyrics, not only the framing of this whole riddle of human existence, which is so intensely illuminated by psychedelic drug experience, but also the interesting thematic encounter between perspectives from science and perspectives from religion. Is the meaning of life to be understood in, you know, these narrowly materialistic, logically reductionist scientific terms? We're really just replicating coils of some DNA. And by the way, that movie came out just a few years after Dawkins' book, The Selfish Gene, had been published. And I clearly see the influence of that, you know, groundbreaking book in that. And meanwhile, that is compared and contrasted with, or is it about whether there's a God or not? And again, in the entertainment arts, these things are frequently and repeatedly spelled out so beautifully. And of course, there are profoundly different answers proposed about the meaning of life and what's it all about, Alfie, coming from these different perspectives. And how do we reconcile and harmonize these different perspectives if we can? Or do we simply dismiss one and cleave to the other? You know, these are some of the things we scratch our heads about. And I tell you, I don't know. Let me ask you if you've ever seen another movie. It stars Dustin Hoffman, came out back in 1970, and it's called Little Big Man.
You know, I'm not sure if I have seen that or not. It sounds vaguely familiar, but, you know, who knows? I've seen so many movies
I couldn't tell you. Yeah, and of course, so many movies are trivial viewing experiences that don't really go to the depths of human experience. They're just some little drama or intrigue, and that can be quite good, and we can see reflections of all these things in those, too. But, you know, the reason I bring up Little Big Man is because one of the most compelling illuminations of, one attempt to grapple with the meaning of life is reflected in that film when Dustin Hoffman's backstory is that he was orphaned early in life and adopted by Plains Indians, the Cheyenne, as I recall, and raised a pale face among the Indians as an adopted Indian and taught Indian ways. And basically, he received an Indian instruction in the meaning of life and the spiritual and all that, which, of course, is profoundly non-Western. Later on, he gets bushwhacked back into European-American culture and tries to readapt to that. And in his adventures, he comes into association with a kind of a medicine show huckster or snake oil salesman, a con man, if you will. And they're having a little talk at the campfire in private, where this whole confrontation between one worldview and another becomes the central theme. And the snake oil salesman, for all his moral corruption or whatever you want to call it, he tells Dustin Hoffman, son, your problem is this vision of some kind of moral, intelligent order in a universe, some kind of transcendent thing that you got from your Indian grandfather, when the truth is there ain't no moral order in the universe. We know this because scientists have now trained their telescopes up in the skies, and we've seen that there's no heaven up there. Those stars overhead twinkle in a vacuum. And human beings, you know, for all our talk about human worth and dignity and meaning and what's important, for all our big brains and opposable thumbs, we're really just smart two-legged animals who wander the face of the earth scheming and dreaming in vain, because the truth is there is no truth except that we're basically all fools and nothing matters. And the sooner you realize that, the better for you, because what it comes down to is, you know, people are either going to be sheep or they're going to be shearers of the sheep. You know, you can, you know, be prey species or you can be predator. That's the choice that we have. And I personally would rather wear silk and gold and be one of the predators, not the prey. So if you're smart, that's the point of view you'll take. Now, that's a beautifully hilarious and poignant capitulation of this sort of what I would call toxic anti-spiritual worldview that comes from too obsessive a reading of scientific knowledge and a scientific worldview of one sort that is uniquely narrow, and it's going to just sort of try to dismiss or debunk any of these questions about the meaning of life. But I'll tell you something else that is really cool in this scene, because as this guy, the snake oil salesman, is getting all off into painting this picture of a meaningless existence in which the main thing is to eat well and drink well and be merry because tomorrow we die. And during this, Dustin Hoffman says, "Hey, did you just hear something?" You see, this guy is so obsessed in his vision, he's not even aware of what's going on around him. But Dustin Hoffman, who is not so consumed with all this, he hears something behind those bushes. And he tries to bring it to the guy's attention. This guy isn't paying any attention to what Dustin Hoffman is trying to tell him. He says, "Listen to me, son. You know, you're not paying attention." And guess what it is behind the bushes? It's a tar and feather posse who is listening to this conversation and has heard about enough now, because they've got some people in the hospital over this snake oil that someone bought from this guy. And, you know, I mean, right there, the ramifications of this toxic worldview are a constriction of awareness, whereas Dustin Hoffman, who's not all filled up with that, he kind of detects what it is in the world around him. He sees things, he hears things, he notices things. This other guy is consumed with the blindness of his own toxic, hyper-scientific, hyper-materialistic worldview. And indeed, I think there is a question of how do we regard scientific knowledge and understanding, which is awesome and powerful, in regard to this other dimension of life that we might call transpersonal or psycho-spiritual, this thing that the effects of psychedelic drugs, especially this mystical consciousness phenomenon, which I see as its overarching importance, you know, things that puts us in touch with. How do we relate one to the other? And this ongoing question is a major theme of these studies. And by the way, I think sometimes that almost any answer that one could propose to such a question could never be as satisfying or fulfilling or persuasive as simply a clear framing and asking of the questions themselves. Sometimes it's better to just have that question. Sometimes it's better to just have that story in which these themes are revealed, not some kind of ongoing intellectual discussion about all those themes. And that's one of the things I love about the intellectual tradition of Native societies, as I've discovered from my studies, that, you know, in Western civilization, we have this whole 2,500-year history of hyper-intellectual debate about the meaning of life and what is reality. We have philosophy ever since ancient Greece with its branches of metaphysics, you know, they talk about what is the nature of reality, ontology, what is the nature of existence and being, epistemology, what can we truly say we know, and how do we know that we know, and what does it mean to say that we know something, what is knowledge, and of course, you with your Gnostic media business, you know, Gnostic is a word that is closely related etymologically to the word knowledge or know. And it's very much at the heart of this whole search for meaning, which we might equate with the holy grail of our entire adventure as human beings. It's kind of the fire under the ass of our entire history and intellectual legacy.
Meanwhile, the Indians are...
I
was just going to say, meanwhile, the Indians are sitting around experiencing the world while we're talking about it or something to that effect, right?
Yeah, not just talking about it, but even babbling incoherently if we're not careful, because to actually make clear sense about this stuff is quite a challenge. And in Western philosophy, you know, we're like, we're determined, we're going to engage it at that level. But the Indians, as you say, are not only sitting around tuning into it, but they're also discussing it in a completely different way when they do speak of it. And namely, it comes in the form of stories that they tell. And it's in these stories that the wisdom is packed, just concentrated. And, you know, one of my favorite books, you know, that reveals this, I wonder if you're familiar with this work, Black Elk Speaks by Neihardt, which is an account of a Lakota medicine man. And at the beginning of the book, Black Elk begins by recounting his people's stories of mythic origins, and he makes a spellbinding statement. He says, now, I want to preface this account by explaining to you very honestly that I wasn't there when all this happened, and I don't actually know whether the events in this story actually happened in the way that they're told. But, nonetheless, if you think about this story, I think you will see that it is true. And that's an amazing statement because it raises this whole interesting question of, well, where does truth really lie and which way should we look in our pursuit for truth? And that's really, I think, one of the compelling instincts that arises psychospiritually in connection with psychedelic drug experiences. It kind of opens our eyes to this, you know, a vivid experience of what is the meaning of life and what is going on when our spidey sense begins tingling, seeing those stars overhead, or seeing a scene of majestic, incredible natural beauty that stops us dead in our tracks, clears our mind for a moment of whatever else was bothering us, and immerses us in an experience of pure awe and wonder. And that is the best, for me, analogy, or I should say it is an important analogy for understanding this phenomenon of mystical consciousness, an analogy that comes not from psychedelic drug effects per se, but from something much broader and more fundamentally human and universal to our experience. And it's in these analogies that I find the most potent clues to understanding what's going on with this, because another perspective that arises for me from this, from having experienced and having studied all this, is that in that mystical consciousness, there is a stunning realization and a very vivid sense of knowing more about this whole riddle of existence and meaning of life and the human condition than one has ever known before and perhaps can ever know again. And yet, that knowledge, profound as it is, does not equate to what we might call understanding. Indeed, in the wake of that psychedelic experience, if anything, one is now awakened to a kind of a search for understanding about what does this really mean? How am I to understand this? How am I to make a connection between this and everything I've known before and since? You know, Huxley talks about that in his book, Doors of Perception. You know, it's all well and good to have an experience of psychedelic effects revealing these depths to us, revealing this mystery of existence in such vivid, unshakable detail. And yet, it is still, to reap the benefits of that experience, it is still critical that we achieve some kind of breakthrough and understanding. We have some kind, we acquire some kind of insight, nourished by understanding and knowledge in other fields that relate to it, that give us the clues to help us to understand and make the connection between what we have experienced in that psychedelic moment of transcendence and what it is telling us in larger frame that is not really unique to psychedelic drug effects. It's unique to human existence and the meaning of life and the riddle of all existence, what connects us to the entire cosmos. And, you know, this is something that we really struggle with and which psychedelic drugs, their effects, this mind-expanding effect, really seems to shed a tremendous light upon.
Well, let me.
And normally these depths are... Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to ask you, let me ask you, with all of this, how did you end up tiring, number one, of anthropology? And number two, what is it that you find most interesting about mycology that led you into that?
Well, anthropology is one window upon the human condition, and especially looking at it in cross-cultural light. And in the course of getting my master's degree, I certainly learned a lot about that. But of course, my focus, what was driving me, was not really just an interest in the cross-cultural realm. It's what light that would shed upon this whole much bigger, larger topic, and especially in the wake of these experiences. By the way, I also had coursework beyond my master's degree in anthropology because I was in a PhD program in anthropology at another university, which I did not complete. Rather, I made a transition into botany and mycology because, on the one hand, I was sort of already learning the larger share of what I needed to gather from cross-cultural study, and on the other hand, there was this whole hard scientific aspect to the whole thing, because ultimately, you know, these psychedelic agents, different plants and fungi with the compounds they contain, you know, getting a hold of that kind of understanding, that kind of systematic knowledge, was a major piece of acquiring a completely integrated understanding about this subject. And I had always, by the way, been very interested in scientific topics. I don't know about you, Jan. I was the kind of kid when I was young who would go down to the library, and I would have these little pet obsessive interests in one thing and another, and frequently scientific topics. You know, I was cleaning out the library for all their books on astronomy at one phase, and, you know, getting the telescope and looking at all these things and studying all these things. And then in another phase, it was going to be insect collecting and butterflies. And, you know, that was the context in which I actually first started learning Latin names and taxonomy and, you know, a lot of fundamental concepts. And yet it was really all just sort of what might be called, you know, boyish hobby interests, in which I learned a tremendous amount. But adults sometimes said, you know, you're going to be a scientist one day when you grow up. So I think by my personality disposition, I've just always been tremendously interested in science and sciences. And sooner or later, maybe it was inevitable as I wandered far from that field into studies of comparative religion and ethnography and ethnology that eventually I would come back to it, especially when these are all pieces of the puzzle that I had realized in the wake of psychedelic experience. And before I studied mycology in a graduate program, I was already, you know, in connection with this sort of science hobby tendencies, I was already a semi-competent amateur mycologist. I had already been out on quite a few mushroom hunts, and I had already taken spore prints and looked at the spore deposits and seen the colors of them and taken steps towards identifying mushrooms. I already had a pretty good amateur background, and that was one of the reasons that I was able to get into a PhD program in mycology, because my background, you know, comparative religion and anthropology, was not the kind of thing that the people who make decisions about who they're going to let into a botany and mycology program would look at and say, hey, here's someone with a lot of qualifications. If anything, they would look at that and they'd say, here's someone who shows no evidence of any prior interest in this stuff and who is not likely to do well in our program. And I did have to sit down with some of those decision makers and tell them at a certain point, well, you know, I can understand what you're saying and why you might want to close the door on me and not admit me to your program, but if you have a second and don't mind my, you know, talking to you a little bit, what I'd like to do is, if I may, use reason and logic and give you some information that might shed a different light on it, because it's quite likely that although 90% of people with my background would do terribly in your program, I probably represent the 10% exception to that rule, and I would probably do very well in your program. And next thing I know, I was admitted.
Very interesting stuff, Brian. And well,
I got a lot more where that came from, Jan.
So, anyway, what led you from all of that into Gordon Wasson's work? And in your opinion, what are Wasson's most valuable contributions to the field of ethnomycology? And you know, with him sort of being the founder of the field.
Well, of course, Wasson is a key figure in the history of studies of sacred mushroom in Mexico and the traditions of various native peoples there pertaining to the sacred mushroom, psilocybe. And, you know, so in the context of studying mycology, fungi, and in the context of studying anthropology, especially with a view toward this whole phenomenon of psychedelic drug effects and the traditions surrounding them, Wasson studies were certainly something that came to my attention. And, of course, he had very broad-ranging studies. One of his greatest contributions, I think, you know, he was not a professional scientist or anything like that, but, you know, just a person who was educated and happened to have a very lively interest in fungi and their role across culture and for purely personal reasons. But on the one hand, one of his great contributions was his advance of study of Mexican mushroom traditions. You know, this is something that really had a little minor renaissance of study in the pre-World War II era. In anthropology and ethnobotany, especially Richard Evans Schultes. And that came to Wasson's attention in the early 1950s when he was studying fungi across culture. And, you know, he had developed this idea that it may be that mushrooms were somehow more involved in religion or had some kind of spiritual significance widespread in prehistoric times. And the echo of this we see nowadays is worldwide dispersion of traditions pertaining to mushrooms, which are either markedly negative or positive. Mycophilic or mycophobic was his terms for this. And he saw the survival of Mexican mushroom traditions as a major study that would possibly shed light on his theory. And I think for Wasson, the significance of those mushroom traditions in Mexico was the evidence that they provided, suggesting that maybe his speculation or theory about a prehistoric, more widespread role of mushrooms in religion and spiritual practices, shamanism or whatnot, may have been not so far off the mark. And, you know, the perspective on this theoretically is still somewhat sketchy and still somewhat hazy, but another aspect of his contribution was that when he went down there, he didn't do it in a purely bumbling, stumbling manner. He actually contacted authorities in various fields and established professional, collegial working relations with them. For instance, just in identifying what species of mushrooms are these that the Indians use, Wasson brought on board French mycologists who were experts in dark spored mushrooms, and in order to understand, well, what's in them, what's accounting for these hallucinogenic effects, they contacted the world's foremost authority on that, which would be Albert Hoffman in Basel, Switzerland, the guy who first synthesized LSD and a few years later discovered its psychedelic effects. And, you know, he brought world-class expertise to bear upon the many different aspects of this problem. He brought French anthropologists over there to study those rites. And so ultimately what he did was his activities led to a greatly advanced, greatly expanding knowledge of these traditions and understanding, and also, I might add, a public awareness and direction of public attention to the fact of these Mexican mushroom ritual traditions and to the very fact of the existence of these hallucinogenic fungi, which was something that was, I mean, it was known to a very small group of specialists in certain fields before that, but there was no widespread public awareness about this at the time. And basically, his discoveries initiated a cascade of historic events that ultimately led to the moment of you and me sitting here right now having this conversation.
Indeed.
And it's kind of staggering to kind of...
I was just saying, indeed.
Yes, I heard that. It's it's something to consider. And, you know, Timothy Leary would never have been Timothy Leary as history knows him, famous or infamous, depending on how you view his checkered or ambiguous legacy. You know, he did some good things, and then he did some other things we might discuss. But, you know, and that is actually part of the challenge and the problem with the fact of psychedelics and our society and the future of our civilization, because it's like, you know, what place, if any, now that we know about these things and now that people have experienced these things and continue to experience them, what comes out of that? And some of what comes out of it is nothing to celebrate. For instance, the passage of laws in the 1960s making possession and use of these things against the, the law. And which, you know, doesn't exactly encourage research on these things, and we need to know more about this stuff. That's why I'm so sort of happy to see Roland Griffith's research, especially focusing as it does on this interesting, deepest central layer of the onion, which is this phenomenon of cosmic consciousness, or as Stanislav Grof referred to it in your interview with him, mystical consciousness. And it's very encouraging to see someone trying to pick up the reins and study that, because, you know, part of me has this slightly anguished sense that again reminds me of the book Black Elk Speaks that I mentioned earlier, because as Black Elk tells about these origins and as his story unfolds, we learn that actually his heart is filled with grief because his people, whose culture and population thrived before the impact of Western encroachment, you know, they had a connection to the sacred. There was a kind of a closed circuit, like an electrical circuit, where the energy was flowing. He refers to it as the sacred hoop. And as he's explaining, that sacred hoop has been battered and smashed and broken, and its pieces are scattered. And there's a kind of a Humpty Dumpty principle at work here, something maybe delicate and easily broken, but putting it all back together again, maybe a completely another proposition beyond the power of all the king's horses and all the king's men, and there's no clear view that it's ever going to be restored. It's gone with the wind, lost forever. And as I look at the history of psychedelic drugs, oh, go ahead.
I wanted to ask you, in your book, you present translations of studies that were previously only available in French and Spanish regarding mycology and all of this material that hadn't been out available to the public by Wasson and his associates. Could you talk about these studies and how hard were they to track down, and what led you to the realization that these studies should be available in English?
Well, as I was pursuing my path of study, I was, you know, just hungry for information from the knowledge base. And, you know, I'm an English speaker, so I devoured the English literature on it. But I also saw references repeatedly to certain works in other languages, most notably Spanish, works by Mexican authorities on these native peoples and their mushroom traditions. And from seeing these, I realized that there's likely to be some very significant information content in these articles. And so working through interlibrary loan offices at colleges and universities I was stationed at over the years, I acquired most of the articles. There was one about the mushroom traditions of the Matlatsinka Indians, which I found working through seven different colleges and universities. Nobody could get their hands on it. The others I was able to acquire through interlibrary loan, no problem. But I eventually had to contact the world's leading authority in the genus psilocybe, Dr. Gaston Guzman, down in Mexico, and asked him if he knew of any sources where I could acquire this one really hard to get article on in Spanish on the Matlatsinka Indians. And lo and behold, no wonder Dr. Gaston Guzman happened to have a copy of that article, and he took digital photographs of the pages and sent them to me one by one, and that's how I acquired the text of that article. And so basically what I did was I translated all these sources into English so that, first of all, I would be able to read them comfortably and easily and figure out what they're saying. And then, you know, once I realized the value of these things, I thought, well, maybe there are other people out there studying this who would also like to have access to this information, and altogether they seem like ideal material for, you know, compiling together into a little edited volume or book, and so that's what prompted me to bring that out.
What is the most important aspect of your work in this regard?
Well, I'm not sure there is anything important about it, unless someone out there has an interest in this, that would lead them to also want to access that information. And, you know, I put that book out there just to make that information available. It's not a commercial work. It's, published by a university press, and it's highly specialized. It does not target, popular interest particularly. It's not some kind of in-depth discussion of anything like that. It's just presenting views from anthropology, studies of different Indian tribes and their mushroom traditions, so that anyone trying to gather a greater knowledge and understanding about that will have that as a resource.
Well, I think it's, in my own case, I did find it a very fascinating book, because it really goes into a lot of detail on a lot of the early studies that Wasson and Hoffman and Heim, I believe, who, you know, they reported all of these findings in these studies that basically only went into French and Spanish. And we were left basically with a Time Life article and all of this other fantastic right. research, and these other stories went into these other languages. And so for me, it was interesting to be able to finally read, you know, and I had heard about some of these studies, and you come across the references, but for me, having minimal understanding of French and Spanish, it was nice to be able to sit down and finally study these works.
Well, thanks. And it's a pleasure to know that, because, you know, you have to have a pretty lively interest in this subject to delve into the depths of it that those articles deal with. But there is, you know, an impressive diversity and richness of the shamanistic traditions in Mexico among different native peoples pertaining to those mushrooms, as I guess you understand well.
I do. What different cultures that you're aware of used the mushroom or use the mushroom in Mexico?
Well, they're cultures that, for the most part, nobody up here has ever heard of. We're familiar with the Sioux and the Comanche and the, you know, we know all these names of Indian nations north of Mexico, but down in the mountains of southern Mexico and adjoining regions, you know, the small peoples, the little tribes or whatever who have these traditions have names such as the Miche and the Mixtec and the Matlatzinca and the Mazatec, also known as the Wahutec. And, they're little humble peoples who have been living there for who knows how long, practicing their customs and traditions, living their lives pretty much tucked away in obscurity from the broader awareness of the modern world. And it was really the study of these mushroom traditions that has brought to wider attention the fact of some of these interesting cultures down there.
How did the study of calendars come into play in Wasson's studies? And I found that quite interesting because of the overlapping in my own studies. But how did that affect Wasson's work, and what was his interest in that?
Well, that's discussed in one of the chapters of my book, which is a translation of an article by Walter Miller on the Miche Book of Days, a sort of sacred ritual calendar that we find references to the sacred mushrooms in that calendar. This calendar, on the one hand, you know, it functions as a way of keeping time, especially for, you know, important purposes ranging from agriculture, when do we have to plant the crops, etc., to things like what day you were born on and what does this portend for the trajectory of your life, almost like a horoscope or zodiac. And each day of the calendar, any one of which a person may be born on, is associated with a totem-like figure, you know, almost like we have the zodiac or the horoscope with 12 signs. Each one has its little figure associated with it that, you know, t- tells something about the fate of the person. And that Book of Days down in this culture, the Nihei, is actually, it's going to be like a predictive or diagnostic tool. A person wants to know, based on the day they were born on, what is the little sign or personification of nature associated with it? What animal are they born under the sign of? It's not organized by 12 months. It's organized by days of the year. And the person, you know, wanting to know what day they were born on and what their animal counterpart is, or their sign, if you will, like we would say sign of the zodiac, for much of their life, you know, they're going to have a certain regard for that species of animal. They're going to be careful not to kill it or something like that. And but the mushrooms do figure in this, and it was the connection there to the sacred mushrooms that was of interest to the author of this article, Walter Miller, who had lived for years and studied the customs of Nihei Indians. And that's a really enjoyable and informative little piece, I find. And, you know, a lot of people have never heard of that little sacred ritual calendar of those Indians and the connection to the sacred mushroom traditions. Maybe a completely new aspect of the subject for some readers.
Yeah, I hadn't heard of that before, and I was very interested in that. You know, and let me bring this up. A lot of people talk about the quote-unquote mushroom cult of Mexico. Was there just one cult, or were there different cultures with different rituals and different practices that used different mushrooms, or was it all just the same thing? Are we talking about one cult, or is this, you know, different practices and different cultures spread throughout Mexico?
That is a potentially misleading phrase, you know, the mushroom cult, as if it is some singular, unitary phenomenon. And the word cult, as used by anthropologists, actually has a completely different connotation from other contexts in which we see the word cult used. And that in itself is perhaps unfortunate, because that invites misunderstanding. You know, in anthropology, cult is really just a figure of speech referring to the religious practices of a certain group of indigenous people, non-Western. And for instance, Weston Labar, his book about peyote customs, it's called The Peyote Cult. But again, as with the phrase the Mexican mushroom cult, it shouldn't be understood as applying to some organized, centralized, unified, cohesive religion. What you really have is a kind of a large frame tradition within which there's a great deal of diversity, especially by different cultures. And what we see in Mexico is a number of native peoples who do have traditions involving the sacred mushrooms. They're fundamentally ritualistic or shamanistic in nature, and there are many, many striking similarities. It's clear that they have some kind of cultural, historical connection. They didn't just all arise independently. And they do all use species of psilocybe, although they tend to use the species that are available in their local region, and different tribes use different species as available in their habitats. And there's a tremendous number of blue-bruising psilocybe species in Mexico, and there's probably about 20 species altogether that are used by different native peoples. And their customs and practices do show interesting similarities and differences also, and not just between and across cultural lines, but even within individual cultures, there's interesting variation in how different shamans would use them. And it's just a whole fascinating field of study.
So what does that say for the origins of the mushroom practices?
I think it says that they do have a common cultural ancestry that probably extends back in time very far. And as you know, Jan, the part of the Wasson theorizing about this, and it's shared by other anthropologists who have studied this, by the way, is that it's not unlikely, perhaps, that this use of psilocybe in Mexico is part and parcel of a larger framework within which all kinds of hallucinogenic plants are used, among all kinds of people, including peyote, and that The shamanistic use of mind-altering plants and fungi may have been a cultural motif that was already up and running, already installed, and well in place all the way back to the time that the first ancient Paleo-Siberian ancestors of the first Americans crossed over from eastern Siberia into Alaska by means of this land bridge that was in place during the Ice Age, when so much of the world's waters were locked up on land as ice that ocean levels had dropped significantly, exposing regions of land that, you know, in the case of that part of the world, were connecting North America, Alaska, to Siberia as parts of a single landmass, and those ancient peoples crossed over into our continent, you know, apparently without having any sense that, hey, we're populating the new world. We're crossing over and becoming the first Americans. But it's thought that probably the Paleo-Siberians already had customs involving use of mind-altering plants or fungi, and as we well know, in historic times, the ethnographic present, we do see use of a psychoactive fungus, fly agaric, not psilocybe, among some native groups of Siberia in shamanistic rituals, and that's part of the evidence that connects all this.
What do you think was Wasson's most valuable contribution made to this field of research?
I would say on the one hand, it is the general perspective of a much greater role for psychedelic plants and fungi in general, and fungi in particular, across culture, going back into prehistory than was ever realized or even suspected before he put together his team of colleagues. And on the other hand, more specifically, it would be the advances that resulted from his research activities in Mexico and Central America. I mean, our knowledge of the genus psilocybe has been radically expanded and improved as a direct result of that. Our knowledge of Mexican Indian customs, our knowledge of shamanistic rituals, our knowledge of psychopharmacology, you know, the discovery of psilocybin and psilocin by Hoffman based on analysis of psilocybe material that was obtained from cultures originating in Mexico and grown over in laboratories in the late 1950s and then sent to Hoffman. And, you know, consider a world in which nobody had ever heard of psilocybin or psilocin.
Was Wasson the first to discover or know about the indigenous use of mushrooms, or just the first to actually try them in an indigenous ritual setting with a curandera Maria Sabina?
He was not he did not discover, you know, the fact of these sacred mushrooms or their ritual use in Mexico. That was already established. But as you said, he was the first, along with a few in his party, to actually be invited by his Indian hosts to directly partake of the shamanistic sacrament with them and to experience the effects of those hallucinogenic fungi. And on the other hand, he was also almost single-handedly responsible for bringing concerted multidisciplinary attention by world-class experts in different fields vital for the study of this to bear upon the phenomenon, because up to that time it was a very obscure thing that was scantily known by very few experts and not in any great depth. But he picked up the pieces of what had been discovered before and then, you know, orchestrated all of this really high-level activity, investigating and researching it, and this is what has led to a greatly increased knowledge of mushrooms, greatly increased knowledge of psychopharmacology, the existence of a whole class of drugs with LSD-like effects. You know, we take that for granted now, but at the time that he went down there, well, we knew about mescaline and we knew about LSD, and that was about it.
One thing that I wanted to ask you was, and I'm thinking about Andy Letcher's book when I asked this question, Andy Letcher's book, Shroom. Would you discuss any difference, if any, between entheogens used for healing versus religious use?
Well, that's an interesting question, because the traditional context, not only in native societies, but even in Western civilization, the traditional context of healing or procedures for curing or medicine itself is a kind of a religious or ritual or shamanistic concept or context. And, you know, nowadays we live in an era where, you know, conventional Western medicine, allopathic medicine, if you will, is scientific in its foundation. And we're glad to have a scientifically based medicine, but we still do have alternative healthcare approaches that partake of, you know, a little bit of that ancient tradition. By the way, it was only in the 1840s, as recently as the 1840s historically, that the American Medical Association was founded, and with the specific mission of trying to establish medicine on solid scientific grounds, because of the fact that its traditional context is one of a religious or spiritual nature, you know. And we still see in our own society, even with modern medicine, as we look across the spectrum of different ideas and practices and beliefs and traditions, on one side of the ideological spectrum, we do have a kind of a continuation of that ancient thing in the most conservative branches of mainstream religion. I'm referring to faith healing, laying on of hands, praying for recovery from illness, and so on and so forth. If we go over to the opposite end of the ideological spectrum, what we see is an interesting restatement or recapitulation of this ancient connection. And here I'm thinking in terms of things that are sometimes incorporated into what we might loosely refer to as New Age interests or preoccupations, and involving anything from acupuncture or other practices that we might draw upon from other cultures, or involving things that are innovated, like, hey, use crystals to heal you, or something like that, and we see it, or something called Reiki, or a counterpart of it that we see sometimes called therapeutic touch, and these sorts of things, which are not really part and parcel of that scientific foundation of medicine, but stand in distinction to it, and, you know, have an interesting similarity or parallel to the ancient laying on of hands and faith healing and that whole context, even though the ideological basis of it is strongly opposed. You know, one comes from the left, the other one comes from the right ends of our culture.
And the left and right hemispheres of the brain, I might add. Were Amanita muscaria mushrooms, as far as we know, used in Mexico?
Well, we certainly don't see them used nowadays, and there's no real strong evidence for it, but there is some vague suggestion from studying names of different Indians down in central Mexico for fly agaric, and also, you know, from looking at some of the archaeological artifacts that depict mushrooms, where in some cases, you know, if we squint a little bit and look at it long enough, it looks like, you know, that mushroom that is depicted doesn't look as much like a psilocybe as it does like a fly agaric. And if there is, in fact, a connection between the native New World narcotic complex, as it has been called, the shamanistic traditions involving mushrooms especially, and ancient ancestral Paleo-Siberian use of fly agaric, then, you know, that might also speak to the possibility of fly agaric having, at one time in the past, been a fungus used in a shamanistic context in Mexico or in the New World. There is actually some, you know, sketchy reports about suggesting such a thing in the Great Lakes region. And, you know, certainly the Indians know of the fly agaric, but as far as I know in Mexico, it's generally traditionally avoided as something not to fool around with.
What do you think of the similarities between the Mexican ideas of where Jesus came from with the spittle or ejaculation and where the mushrooms grew as compared to similar stories in Poland and elsewhere?
I can't say I have any particular thoughts about that. The information I have about this is fairly sketchy and not real rich. And on the other hand, I'm also, you know, as you probably know from previous conversations you and I have had about this business, I'm a little bit hesitant to draw any definite conclusions or form any definite thoughts about these things before I have more information about it. So, you know, inconclusive.
Discuss Fernando Benitez and Aldous Huxley.
Oh, well, of course, Huxley is the author of Doors of Perception, which was this book that came out in 1954, eloquently and cogently discussing this psychedelic mystical experience, as it came to be called in the 1960s. And Fernando Benitez is this Mexican author who wrote of his experience with mushrooms among the Mazatec Indians of Mexico. And the translation of Benitez's book, which is called The Hallucinogenic Fungi, Los Hongos Alucinantes, appears in my book as chapter 6. And Benitez is a really good writer, and he does a uniquely interesting job, I think, of discussing and describing his experiences under the effect of the hallucinogenic mushrooms, as well as the circumstances under which he experienced this. And he's actually written quite a bit on Indians of Mexico, and he's been remarked upon as a very keen and sensitive observer of native culture there. And his, you know, the translation I rendered of his book, The Hallucinogenic Fungi, in my book, Sacred Mushrooms of Mexico, really goes into vivid writerly detail about what he experienced. And one of the things I really love about his account, and I wonder if you had any sense of this from your reading of it, is that there's a kind of a poignant and refreshing bearing of his soul in his account, whereby, because a lot of what he experienced, at least in his first mushroom trip with the Indians, is not something that might casually be referred to as a good trip. In fact, he experienced quite a bit of, I'm a little bit not inclined toward terms like good trip and bad trip, because I think they do invite as much misunderstanding as any light they shed. Yeah, you and I have had some discussions about this, and I think, you know, I have my own sense about that from those talks we've had. And really, I would like to use a phrase such as adverse reaction. And there's no doubt, reading that book, that he's going into that with his first trip. But the thing is, this is something that, you know, I think anyone who has any extensive experience with psychedelics does run into in some form to some extent. And, you know, not every sensation, thought, or feeling arising in the context of psychedelic experiences, how to put it, sunshine and lollipops. And, you know, it's not everything is living in a gingerbread house on Lollipop Lane. And when he goes into this, it's like, I think that there can be a kind of a difficulty grappling or engaging with that content because it is so deeply personal and unpleasant. And, you know, he goes into this, it's hard to find people who can really confront and discuss that stuff openly and tell the truth about it from the, tell their own truth about it, whatever that is, because it's just, it's, one is too vulnerable, one is too exposed in that moment. Our natural instinct reflex is to kind of cover up and protect and shield ourselves. And he doesn't do that. He kind of throws some of those constraints aside and really, you know, we see the content of his trip, all this sort of psychic conflictedness and elements of shame. And he really, you know, it takes quite a man to talk about that stuff that way, was the feeling I had reading that. And I don't know, did you have any sense of that from reading it?
Yeah, it was. That's why I bring it up, because I felt that his account was very detailed and thorough and open, as well as your translation of it to English. Not having read the Spanish translation, I can only imagine, but I thought that even the English translation was very eloquent and put together, and that it hit some deep core themes there. So absolutely.
That's cool. I'm glad that worked for you, because, you know, that is a really unique discussion of one man's encounter with the sacred mushroom, and it's hard to find its equal anywhere.
You're working on a new book, Through the Doors of Perception. You brought up a little bit of it at the beginning of the discussion. Why don't you bring it full circle and talk a little bit more about your upcoming work?
I'd be happy to. Thanks for asking. You know, this is a work completely unlike The Sacred Mushrooms of Mexico, because my unpublished book, Through the Doors of Perception, is centrally focused on this fascinating phenomenon of psychedelic mystical experience, which I think is the overarching central importance of this entire thing for all the light that it sheds on so much that is of such profound significance for us as individuals and for human existence in broadest frame. And it raises in clearest form all the deepest questions that we could ever have, and it doesn't necessarily answer those questions, but it points us in certain directions. If we can see the finger and which way it's pointing, it points us in directions that we might be able to go and obtain something resembling answers to those questions, at least for ourselves as individuals, if indeed answers can ever be found. And it discusses this phenomenon, especially bringing in the perspective, the combined perspective, not only of all my studies of it in different fields, but also my personal experience of it. And, you know, if it would be useful, I'd be happy to, you know, give a little bit of that perspective, because it is considerably curious and uniquely interesting. And there is an overarching sense of its meaning and importance. And, it's really, I think one thing that would really benefit and advance understanding about this is if we could get more insight about it from people who can discuss it in its rawest terms and go past that level of, you know, colors, trails, and all the most superficial sensory manifestations of psychedelic effects, because this is the stuff that lies at the core. And to me, to understand this cosmic consciousness phenomenon, we need analogies coming from different sources. I mean, for one thing, it is undeniably, I think, a deeply, you know, a profound experience that takes in what we might consider philosophical and spiritual themes and matters, and it ultimately spans questions of one's own personal existence and its meaning within a much larger and ultimate existence of the entire universe. That's why Dr. Buck in his book termed it cosmic consciousness. It is an awareness that one ordinarily takes for granted pertaining to oneself that is somehow expanded to encompass the entire universe and pointing to this whole riddle of existence and the question of the meaning of life. And you know, in a way that really emphasizes a kind of an implicit underlying mystery or puzzle that teases us from deep within the unconscious. It is also an ecstatic experience. It is an experience of transcendent ecstasy. And, you know, some of the little phrases that we hear bandied about from the good old LSD days of the 1960s, phrases like, oh, wow, or mind-blowing. You know, we hear these little figures of speech over and over again. These are important clues to the nature of this. By the way, it is also an experience of tremendous, it is a visionary experience in which one has a feeling of insight. It's as though one's mind and thoughts are now somehow forcefully directed to ponder matters of extreme philosophical, spiritual depth that are always there as part of the conditions and terms of human mortal existence, and yet we don't have these things within immediate view. These things are not in the front of our mind most of the times, and maybe they come up in those rare circumstances where we face death or other various serious things. But in these moments where our mind is directed by this core psychedelic effect to ponder these things, we are also given a kind of illumination of them that we have never had before, and a feeling that goes along with this, or a sense of being able to understand what these questions are, what this riddle is, with a tremendous power and clarity intellectually that we have never known before, and also perhaps a sense of detachment about it, that we're not reacting, but we're sort of responding to what we're experiencing. And another analogy for understanding this lies, I think, in the creative and visionary inspirations of art and music and poetry, and also experiences. You know the word eureka, I have found it. That's very much close to the core sensation of this visionary mystical experience. It carries a sense of realization about these things, and it is also strongly related to the human capacity for wonder, especially at natural spectacles of transcendent beauty we were talking about a little while ago, from the stars twinkling overhead to the rainbow or that majestic sunset, where we are momentarily as if transported by the beauty of it all to a point that our intellect is actually provoked, and we start scratching our head with a vague feeling that this almost seems to mean something. And part of the foundation in psychology of study for all of this, major center, is the work of William James called The Varieties of Religious Experience. And unlike his contemporaries, Freud and Jung, other great psychologists, William James suggested that it was really in states of consciousness, these moments of wonder, for example, that we can probably find the origins or the roots of what we know as religious belief, religious practices, and customs. And, you know, that's a startlingly different theory than other ideas, you know, as propounded by some of the great Victorian thinkers, especially dismissive or debunking ideas. And, you know, like Karl Marx, who said, well, religion is basically mind game, you know, by power forces that are going to, you know, it's the opiate of the masses. And or Freud, who said, well, this is basically, you know, wish fulfillment fantasy. We can't face the reality of death and our mortal predicament because, you know, life is basically a medical condition, the ultimate prognosis for which is not a happy one. And to deal with that psychologically, we would snap like a dry twig and just go nuts if we were living with that. We have to have a way of denying that. And so we make up a figure of a heaven and hell and a god, but of course we know better than all. It's all nonsense, as we've discovered scientifically. And William James, you know, he had a completely different take on all this, which that was an era before the discovery of LSD's effects. And what William James discussed and described, he was the first one to give a really compelling discussion of mystical experience. And he, you know, laid the foundation, which to this day is guiding our understanding about this. This cosmic consciousness or mystical experience, I might also compare it with what you sometimes hear about the moment of death where your entire life flashes before your eyes. According to conventional wisdom, there may be something to it or not. It also has analogies to what we sometimes hear about in Eastern religion as enlightenment, a kind of awakening.
What is the ineffable quality of entheogens?
The word ineffable means it refers to content that is specific, and yet somehow it cannot be formulated in words. And this is one of the hallmarks of mystical experience. One has a sense of revelation, of suddenly seeing the forest for the trees. All one has seen up to this moment are the trees. and one didn't even know it was a forest. And this mystical consciousness, you know, there's an article called LSD and the Implications of Mystical Experience or Experimental Mysticism by Pankey and Richards that really details the fundamental features of mystical consciousness. And one of them is ineffability. And they also point out that this is definitely an experience of the sacred, of some encompassing, ultimate, transcendent good. The sense of which an individual has is that they need to bring their life into harmonious accord with it. It inspires almost by reflex a kind of instinctual surrender and obedience to it without question. And the reason one doesn't question it is because one realizes that this is something that they kind of already knew, but only at an unconscious level, just like the forest and the trees. You know, it's not like you're being shown something that you never saw before. It's just that it was right there before your eyes, and yet you didn't see it. And now you do see it. And, you know, this is simply, that ineffable thing is simply one of the core characteristics of the mystical experience, along with a sense of its objectivity and reality, its noetic quality. It's called a noetic experience. William James was the first one to use that word, as far as I know. And that's actually a variation of the word Gnostic.
If you could summarize for the audience how Chuang Tzu, Oz, Mary Poppins, and Karl Marx roll together into your new work, how would you describe that?
Very challenging question for 2 minutes. Of course, these are, you know, I do draw in my discussion for my unpublished book upon many different themes. You know, as far as Mary Poppins goes and Wizard of Oz, you know, these are stories that are really close to the heart of our Western popular culture and which are also widely and universally known. And one of my feelings is that one thing that would greatly advance the interest in the potential and promise of this fascinating consciousness-expanding psychedelic effect is to somehow bring it into much greater harmony with the conventional mainstream of our culture. And so one thing I seek to do in my book is to use the themes and stories that lie close to the core of our culture right at home, and discuss it in those terms, because those stories evoke the themes that are central to this phenomenon of psychedelic mystical experience, which is really just its cosmic consciousness. And, you know, I really enjoyed a comment that one of your interviewees, Rick Doblin, made, which coincides with this, because he said that, if I remember his interview, one of his, you know, what he would like to see is, if he could, to make psychedelics not an expression or interest or manifestation unique or specific to the counterculture, but rather he would like to make them boring and bring them to the mainstream of the culture. And I really enjoyed hearing that, because I think that is a challenge that lies before us, you know, for the future of our society and psychedelics, and somehow to bring this subject and what it has to offer us closer to the center of our bogeyest, most conventional, corny, down-home, heap-a-living society. To make that connection is probably a vital possibility for extending and broadening and more deeply integrating this phenomenon of psychedelic experience with the future of our society. Failing that, I think that, you know, a tendency toward drift must inevitably be predicted, whereby interest in popular interest in psychedelic drugs becomes more and more marginal or marginalized, more and more an expression or interest exclusively of a counterculture, and also reduced interest within the scientific community with no reinforcement or support to study it particularly. And, you know, we're kind of at a crossroads, and standing at the crossroads and which way do we go is also very much central to this whole theme of the meaning of life and the phenomenon of human existence and what should we do, which way should we go, where do we want to go, what do we want to be, what do we want to become, what is our, not just our origin, but what is our destiny or fate, and can we realize it or is it too late?
What is the most important concept or thought that you would like people to take away from this interview?
I think the one that I just articulated about standing at the crossroads and what is to become of the psychedelic phenomenon in connection or in disconnection with the mainstream of our society. When we look at the Mexican mushroom traditions, what we see are cultures in which the role of the psychedelic effects of those mushrooms are deeply integrated right at the center of the culture and something that the old folks themselves will prescribe and have recourse to, not just the kids or, you know, a counterculture. They are really part and parcel of the entire cultural pattern and way of life of those people. They don't stand in contrast or in opposition to core values, whereas in our society there's a, you know, teeters on the edge of something else that may not be able to become integrated with our culture. I think it would be incredible if in the future of Western society there could be some kind of deepening connective relationship between its core, its conventions, its basic forms, traditional, conventional wisdom of the elders, and where psychedelic drug effects and the light that they shed upon all these profound questions that are unique, not to the effects of those drugs, but to the fact and the nature of human existence itself, what the human condition really is all about, and this theme of the meaning of life and the riddle of our existence. And I think inevitably we end up with a growing connection, which is a hopeful direction, or a growing disconnection, which, you know, I would hate to see that.
And this concludes Gnostic Media Research and Publishing's podcast number 24. We've been listening to Dr. Brian Akers. Brian, could you please give your books, past and future, and any contact information or website information you'd like to provide?
Well, I can be reached at my Hotmail account by email, AkersBP, that's seven letters, all in a row, AkersB as in Brian and P as in Paul, my middle name, at hotmail.com, duh. And my book is The Sacred Mushrooms of Mexico, 2007 University Press of America, and my unpublished book, which I don't have a publishing deal for it or anything like that, so, you know, don't hold your breath yet, but, you know, the title of that, the working title is Through the Doors of Perception, and that's my book about the psychedelic mystical experience and cosmic consciousness and its importance, its meaning, its essence and content, and what it's all about.
And thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate your time today, and maybe we can do this again sometime.
Well, it's been a pure pleasure, Jan, and once again, I greatly appreciate you having me on. You've had a stellar lineup of interviewees, and it's kind of not only a treat for me, but kind of a humbling, tribute to my little minor achievements or publications or work in this area. So thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome.